One who had the most was every 60 years, okay? The shortest time period. Now, the fun part of the cards is you can play with anybody. It's just kind of interesting little things about history or the Bible or science. But there's always something there when you're with people who aren't necessarily believers. They get this little nugget that points them back to the Bible, okay? The answer was B, every 100 years, okay? Now, this historic population, this is the historic population doubling rate on average. Only in recent centuries has it been shortened to every 60 years. So over the last couple 100 years, it's even faster. This hockey stick of increased population has increased significantly. And that's based on science. We now know how to raise more crops. We know how to fight insects. We know how to take care of people better. People live longer. So the population double rate has increased. Based on this known rate, every 100 years, there's twice as many people as 100 years before. It would take 4,500 years, starting with 8 people that came off of Noah's Ark, to reach the current world population of 8 billion people. So the number of people on this planet almost exactly matches what you would expect if we all started from Noah and his 3 sons. Isn't that interesting? So, okay, just a little tidbit. Okay, I'm going to do 2 more. Okay, a biology question. Flies lay 200 eggs at a time. Okay, so every time that fly lays eggs, there's 200 more flies. Ugh. Those flies hatch one day after the eggs are laid. They go through the larva and turn into fully grown adult flies within 10 days. And then each one of them lay 200 more eggs. They live for 3 months. Starting at the beginning of spring, with just 2 flies, if left unchecked and every one of those flies lived, how many flies would there be at the end of the summer? Okay, now here's your choices. There would be 10 million flies. There would be 100 billion flies. There would be 1,000 trillion flies. Or there would be 1 million trillion flies. Okay? How many think A, 10 million? Okay, 1, 2. How many think 100 billion? Raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Okay. How many think 1,000 trillion? You start to not even imagine these numbers. Okay? And lastly, how about 1 million trillion, which is 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18. It's a number with 18 zeros after it. Okay, there was a couple. Okay, here's the answer. There would be 1 million trillion flies if none of them died or were eaten. Now, here's the point. God built checks and balances into all of creation to both feed and control organisms. Without this design, and it is a design, life would be intolerable. There'd be flies everywhere. Okay, last question, real quick. What keeps frogs that live in northern states from freezing to death every winter? A, they migrate south. Sorry, I can't help laughing. I made up some of these answers. Okay. B, they have antifreeze in their blood. C, they burrow 4 foot deep below the frost line. Or D, they put on extra body fat in the fall. Okay, how many think A, they migrate south along with all the other snowbirds? Hitchhike on the cars. Nope. They have antifreeze in their blood. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. They burrow 4 foot deep below the frost line. And okay, that's the majority. They put on extra body fat. You guys are too good. Okay, fat frogs in the fall. Some animals do that. They have antifreeze in their blood. Isn't that interesting? Now that doesn't happen by accident, folks. Imagine drinking antifreeze so you wouldn't die in the winter. Okay? Frogs have a special blood chemistry with glycerol, which is a form of antifreeze, in their blood. Even when frozen solid, ice crystals don't form to puncture their cells. Therefore, they're fine in the spring and they simply thaw out. Isn't that interesting? Now, I'm going to talk about inventions that have been discovered because we've looked at the animal world. Now, antifreeze isn't one of them, but I thought that was kind of interesting. Now, the last thing I want to do before I get started, just this last year, the person who does a lot of my graphic design, a lot of my editing and runs my website, for years she has said, you gotta start making little 2-minute YouTube videos. And I'm thinking, I'm too busy, I don't need to do that. Well, she finally called me. She lives in Springfield, works for AG in the missions department. And she said, I am flying to Midland and we're gonna spend the weekend making videos. So I had to take pages out of these various devotionals. And we made 38 videos in a 2-day period, like all day Saturday and Sunday afternoon. And every week or 2 weeks, they get posted onto my website. People who go to my homepage and click the without a doubt, we were not to have doubts about the truth and reality in God. Without a doubt devotionals, they will link to these videos, and when a new one comes out, they'll get an email. And they're only 2 minutes long. So I want to show you one that's kind of pertinent to fall, because there's this neat little encouragement that connects God to everything around us. And all of us need that. We just need that reminder he's behind it all. So I want you to see these and think about the usefulness of them. So, got to uncover my projector. And it's weird. I've got to work from this screen over here. And we'll hit this one. Only lasts 1 minute and 34 seconds. Okay, you want to bring up the sound? Okay.
The flow of water into the leaves and the flow of sugar out of the leaves starts to get cut off. When that happens, the greens disappear. Green comes from chlorophyll, which is what is making the sugars. Now, why do they turn yellow? Why do they turn red? Green is a combination of blue and yellow. The blue disappears fastest, leaving yellow. The red comes from the sugars in the leaves. And when that yellow mixes with sugars, you get oranges. That's where all that beauty comes from. Now, why didn't God just, make the trees so that they went from green to some sort of a brown black, which is what they ultimately turn? Because God loves color. He loves beauty. He literally did this for us. The entire design of the beauty of fall is because of God's love of beauty. Because God is beautiful. So as you look at these things, don't leave God out of your thinking. He's made all this beauty, not because of the function, but for our enjoyment.
Okay, so now I gotta exit this. Just to say, I'm working the cursor backwards behind me in the opposite direction it's supposed to go. Now I get rid of this. Okay, I'm back in business. Okay. But the point is, email these to your kids and your grandkids a link so they pop up in their email and they just get that little reminder that God's behind it all. And it's short, interesting, visual with lots of video. And so far I've made 52 of them, and I'll continue to make them. And by the way, the one book, the latest devotional called Without Excuse, about twice a month, there's pages that have these little QR codes. You point your phone out, up pops a video. So the goal is to impact people's thinking around us in multiple ways. And I hope everything we're doing this weekend helps you do that. Now, the topic of tonight is discovery and design. And this is a quote by the astronomer who discovered that the orbits around the sun were not circular, but ellipses, and everything rotated around the sun. Galileo leading to, and I've drawn a getting old blank in my head to think of his, not Copernicus, not Galileo, the other huge, Kepler. Johann Kepler. This is a quote by Johann Kepler. He's considered one of the greatest astronomers that ever lived. And he gave credit to everything he discovered back to God. All of these original scientists, from Galileo to Kepler to Copernicus to Louis Pasteur to Michael Faraday, that discovered the electric motor and electroinductions and electroplating and all these things about electricity, Isaac Newton, Lord Kelvin, all these people were Bible-believing Christians who thought the God who made the universe is obviously incredibly intelligent and systematic, so he ought to be able to discover the principles by which things operate. And that's what drove their desire to develop modern science. And all of them believed in a recent supernatural creation by this God. And it didn't keep any of them from laying all the foundations of modern science. So there is no contradiction between the use and study of science and the belief in God's word. And don't ever let anybody mislead you or your children that if you brought creation back into education, we'd be dragged back into the dark ages. It was the belief in God, and there's a creator that brought us out of the dark ages. So it's just all these lies are 180 degrees the opposite of the truth. Now, God's very first command to mankind, after he made Adam and Eve, this is the very end of the book of Genesis, I read it this morning, and he said it twice. God blessed Adam and Eve, and by implication, all humanity, and he said, be fruitful, multiply, fill. This old ancient King James 1500s word, replenish, literally meant fill in its day. Okay, so you got to go back to the context of the language. Fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, everything that moves. Now, that ancient word in Hebrew, dominion, was a 1500s word that came from the original Hebrew word. It has various nuances. And depending on where you use it and what you look up as language study, you find out that it means literally to control, to study, and to understand. To have dominion, you have to understand what you're in control over. To have dominion, you have to be able to control things. Well, that is modern science. Now, this is kind of stunning for me as a scientist. God's first command to mankind was to go do science. Study creation so you can control it. Now, I have to ask myself why. As I said this morning, time, if this represents the whole universe, this box, God made the box. And time is part of the box. So God is not stuck inside of time. It's why he calls himself the Eternal One. It's why he says, I'm the Alpha and the Omega. It's why he says he's always been in existence. It's why God said, before you were born, I knew you. Before he made creation, before the foundations of the universe were laid, he knew us. Because he can see all of the past, present, and future simultaneously. So he knew when he gave his charge over creation, we would disobey him and become sinful. He knew that we would covet creation, gold, silver, wealth. He knew we would pollute creation. He knew we would waste creation. He knew we would worship creation. He knew all that was going to happen. But he still said, take dominion over it. And I had to ask myself, why? Well, there's two primary reasons. The first we find in the book of Romans, and this is such an incredibly important verse. It says, and this is just the beginning of this section of Romans, that what we can know about God is obvious to all human beings because God has shown it to all human beings. The invisible things of God from the creation of the world are clearly seen by looking at what God has made. So every person is without excuse for belief in God because all we have to do is look at what he's made and we will know it couldn't have made itself. And like no time in all human history, this is more true today than any time in the last 4,000, 6,000 years since creation. Because we now know so much about how creation operates. And matter, time, and energy could not make itself. It's the most basic tested law of science, the first law of thermodynamics. Chemicals could never come alive. We've spent billions of dollars and millions of experiments trying to make it happen, and the result's always the same. Chemicals never come alive. They're too complex. Life is too complex. One kind of an animal could never turn into another. The DNA code is a language. Languages don't write themselves. So by looking at creation, we know God exists. And that's what it says. We're without excuse. You can even know his nature and his incredible power by looking at creation. So that's one of the reasons he told us to study creation, so we would know that he exists. And by the way, when you know God exists, you have no excuse for not obeying and following what he has to say. And he's placed his moral laws inside of every one of us. We know right from wrong, just like he's placed physical laws in the rest of creation. And we're going to be held accountable for following them. You get it? This is why, even when people around the world have not heard of Jesus, they will still be guilty before a holy God when they die and face him someday. And it's why missions are so important. We've got to get the truth in front of people of what God has done for them and how their sins can be forgiven, because they're going to be held accountable. Now, the second reason that studying creation is so important is that we can learn so much from it. And this is a verse from Job. It says, "Ask the beasts, and they will teach thee. Ask the birds of the air, and they will tell thee." Now, I'm going to start tonight's talk by looking at a little video put out by David Attenborough as he's doing nature shows. Now, he is an evolutionist. He believes everything made itself. And by the way, Christians who believe God used evolution and evolutionary processes and the Big Bang to make the universe, and stars made chemicals that came alive, and that chemicals are designed to form life, and that life slowly transformed one form into another, and eventually bacteria turned into people, and that is truth and fact and the reality of science and history, and yet they still may or may not be, but they still call themselves Christians. There is no evidence, if any of that's true, from observing creation that God exists. Because if cosmic evolution and chemical evolution and biological evolution are true, then everything just operates without God's ever interacting with it. So you can't study creation and know God exists. See, you can't have it both ways. You can't say you trust God's word and what it says, and you also believe in evolution, because one or the other has to be wrong. And I am telling you, as a scientist, it is the beliefs in evolution, cosmic evolution, chemical evolution, biological evolution, that are wrong. It's just in the fallen human mind, we want to escape the accountability of God, and those beliefs have given us the excuse to do so. That's why ultimately they're so popular. And being creative, we're going to find reasons to believe them if we want to. There's all sorts of evidence, but are you interpreting the evidence correctly? Now, I want to watch this little video about what the film calls nature's greatest artist, because it's kind of interesting the spin that an evolutionist will put on it at the very end, and it's an important little teaching that I want to add. Can I just eat one? I have no idea what I did with it. Isn't that cool? Now, did you notice that last little statement? If this doesn't get him noticed, nothing will. Now, this is an evolutionist. It's got to explain this beauty. Now, by the way, I show this little video in all the South Pacific nations where I'm speaking in their public school systems. And I'll have a big auditorium or an outside arena with 1,000 kids. And when that camera pans back and they can see that enormous, perfect sculpture at the bottom of the ocean, you'll hear this, whoa, gasp of these students. They have never seen something like this, and they're in awe of what God would do. Because that's what happened. God programmed that fish to make that beautiful structure. Now, if you don't want to believe that, you got to come up with some other explanation. And they say, well, that male fish, he wants to attract a babe. So instead of just this little rubble pile, he just makes things over millions of years prettier and prettier, and he attracts better and better looking girls, and that's why it's so beautiful. And by saying that, in their brains, they think they've explained where beauty comes from. It has a useful function, okay? Now, just like colored leaves, they have no useful function. They were put there by God for our enjoyment and amazement. That's why they exist, and they reflect his character. Now, Charles Darwin had the same problem. He came up with the idea that everything just slowly transformed itself from simple creatures to more complex creatures and eventually into human beings. But here's a statement by Charles Darwin. Oh, and I think I've missed the statement. Okay. He said, and I will quote, "When I look at the tail of a peacock, it makes me sick." That's a statement by Charles Darwin. Because he was mad at God in multiple letters, and he wrote over 7,000 letters over a 20-year period to the other scientists around Europe, trying to convince them that evolution was true, because it was considered very controversial and couldn't be true at the beginning. But he swayed the entire scientific community over time. And in many of those letters, he said, and again, I quote, "My goal is to kill God." Why? Because he was so mad at God because his 7-year-old daughter Annie died at 7 years old of some disease. And he looked through the fossil record and supposed geological history, and those rocks are just filled with death and disease long before supposedly mankind existed. So he reasoned correctly. If death and disease have always been around, and people and animals have been dying of these diseases for millions of years, then God is the one who just made death and disease and has nothing to do with mankind's actions. And this God is an evil God, if he exists at all. And I'm going to just try to destroy the belief in God in people's thinking. And he succeeded beyond his wildest imagination, because that's what's happening ever since that time. But what he couldn't explain was beauty. And it was like the peacock is the epitome of beauty. Why does it exist? Well, after his time, ever since then, the story in the textbooks is beauty exists because it has a functional purpose. Flowers are so colorful, so they attract insects. Except when they tested it, they found out that bees and other insects are colorblind. So it didn't work, but it's still repeated over and over again. And they say this fish produces this beautiful structure so it can attract a female. Well, that's just storytelling. And they've said the same thing about the peacock. The male peacock's so pretty so it can attract a mate. Well, they tested it about 20 years ago. There was a scientific research study. They took a peacock and they cut off all those beautiful iridescent eye-shaped beauty. So it just had these stalks sticking out. And the peacock, it was pug ugly compared to the other peacocks, okay? So then they sent the ugly peacock out into a field. They sent a bunch of other male peacocks that had all these beautiful feathers, and then they would send in a female to see which one it would pick. They found out it didn't make a bit of difference. The beautiful feathers had nothing to do with which peacock the female would choose. The beauty is there for beauty's sake, not because it has some functional purpose more often than not. So when you test evolution, you find out it's not true. It's just the students don't get to hear about these things. See, that contradicted the idea they needed to believe in evolution, so it doesn't even show up in the textbooks. But that is a fact. Now, we're going to look at some other inventions, like, you know, we saw this wheel-like structure under the ocean. So here's early experiments in transportation. Or here's another one. I love Larson and his old cartoons. The fag becomes the first fatality of falling asleep at the wheel. Here comes the saber-toothed tiger. But I'm not going to talk about wheels and when the wheel was invented. I suspect Adam probably made the first wheel. I'm going to talk about another mode of transportation that I don't think we would have ever figured out had God not done it first. And it's changed all of history, all of humanity. And that is flight. Now, I'm going to start by showing a little montage that I put together. I went on the YouTube and I typed in early attempts at flight. And there were just a dozen movies. And I had my videographer kind of put them all together in a little montage of people trying to figure out how to fly. Because we learned how to make movies back in the 1880s, okay? After Edison figured it out, how to string pictures together to make movies. We didn't learn to fly until 1903. So for about 20 years, people were able to film some of these early attempts to fly before we had achieved it. I wanted you to watch this little montage, and then we're going to get to the Wright brothers. Okay, now what did all those attempts have in common? Birds' wings. Now, some of them had exactly the right shape of the bird's wings. Some of them were just flat-surfaced, and they weren't designed like bird's wings. But people were looking at birds. I think since the time of Adam, people have been looking at birds and think, man, I wish I could fly. Why? How can I do this? But it wasn't until almost 6,000 years after creation that we finally achieved it. It took 5,800 years to learn to fly. Now, how? You see, the key was the design of the bird's wings. And the Wright brothers and others had figured this out, that when you have air flowing past this particular shape of a thick area and a thin area, the air has to move faster to go up and over the wing at the top. It moves slower at the bottom. That creates low pressure above the wing, high pressure below the wing, and that creates lift. So incredibly heavy objects could be lifted. But it was the Wright brothers that also made the connection. You've got to get it moving fast enough through the air. And you've got to have a very light shape, light craft, if it's really going to lift itself off the air and carry a human being. So they worked on it, went down to Kitty Hawk, and in December of 1903, Orville Wright climbed onto this plane, and it flew a couple hundred yards in a straight line in sustained flight and then landed. Now, I didn't realize this until I went studying this, but they then went and got newspaper reporters and a film crew, and they came back later that week, and they filmed and recorded that very first flight activity of mankind. And I'll show you the film that's now a historical film of the first time in 5,800 years that mankind learned to fly. And by the way, you'll notice, I'm going to point a couple things out, to get the plane moving fast enough, they dropped an enormous weight that shoved the plane forward very rapidly, like throwing a catapult off of a ship. See, that was that weight going up in the tower. This time, both Orville and Wilbur climbed onto the plane. And here comes that weight. And there goes the plane. Now, these are newspaper reporters that have been invited to see this event. That man was so stunned, he dropped to his knee as he's watching this. They can't believe what they're seeing. No human being has ever seen this. And they don't just fly in a straight line. Now, within a week, they're turning and they're banking and they're soaring up and down and higher, coming over the reporters and the film crew, and then they come in for a landing. Now, isn't that cool? And the reason we could do it is because we realized the principles by which God made creation, and we copied the design of birds. Otherwise, it never would have occurred. What we learn from what God has done. Now, what I'm going to talk about for the next half hour are things that we've learned from creation. And it wasn't just learning to fly. The airplane developers continued to look at birds as things continued to develop. You see, as airplanes got faster and faster, they really needed to modify the design of the wings and the airplane themselves. And to do this, especially after World War II, when we started to develop jet airplanes that moved really fast, and this is documented, they went looking at the fastest, most maneuverable bird they could find. And it's called the Swift. Now, the Swift is a bird that loves to fly on level flight, not diving. A peregrine falcon can dive at 200 miles an hour, but on level flight, this is the fastest bird. It can fly in a straight line 104 miles per hour. It's been clocked, screaming past you on an expressway, just on level flight. It flies almost continuously. They put trackers on them, and they believe in their lifetime, and they live for multiple years, they would fly the equivalent of 2.5 million miles. And the reason is they almost never land. They don't like to stop to do anything. That's like 8 times all the way to the moon and back, or about 100 times around the Earth in their lifetime. They drink while they're flying. They don't stop at a bird bath to take a drink. They will swoop down to a lake or a river, open their mouths, grab a drink of water, and swoop back up without ever landing. They just keep flying. They eat while they're flying. They just grab bugs in the air. That's what they eat. They sleep while they're flying. They see them flying at night, and they wonder, why do they do that? They realize, because they studied them in a lab, that they have the ability to shut down half their brain to give it rest, because all mammals need a period of dormancy with their brains. So they'll shut down the right half and close the left eye and keep flying, and then they'll shut down the right eye and the left half, and they'll keep flying. And it's an amazing biological ability. They make babies while flying. The male and the female just get together in the air. The only time they stop is to build a nest, lay eggs, and basically nurture the eggs. This bird loves to fly, and it's fast and it's maneuverable. Now, all of the original airplanes had wings that were straight out. The Wright brothers' plane, the original World War I biplanes, the World War II planes, the early airliners. But as they got faster, you look at all modern planes, and the wings are swept back, just like the Swift. The design came from what God did with that bird. We learned, again, from what he had done. And then there's something else about birds that are in flight that's kind of amazing. The most dangerous maneuver in flight is the period where you're taking off and moving fairly slow to get off the ground, and where you're landing, you have to slow way down. Otherwise, you would need 5 mile long runways. So now we have jet airplanes that are flying at 400 to 500 miles an hour. They're in million pounds of weight, but they have to slow down to land. And when a big heavy object slows down, it loses lift. And at that point, it'll begin fluttering like a leaf instead of flowing smoothly through the air. It's called stalling. Well, the airplane designers, again, thought, how do big birds, like that great big hawk, how does it slow down without losing lift? You see, first of all, it rears back. So now there's forced to be a way more air flowing over the top of the wing, and it gets more lift. And second, it has these little feathers that come out. And here's another picture of a big old Canadian goose. And as it lands, it deploys these extra feathers. That forces more air up and over the wing. Okay, it makes more lift. And you'll notice every modern airplane has flaps on the front edge. And you'll see them coming out as it's coming in for a landing. Do you think an airplane designer just suddenly came up with that? They looked at what God had made, and then they simply copied it. Last example has nothing to do with flight, but it's kind of cool. And to explain it, I'll give you a story. I was walking in the woods. It really happened, like, late in the evening, down a path on a nature trail. And without hearing a thing, all of a sudden, this enormous object came swooping right past me, like a few feet from my head. And it was big. I mean, it was dusk, and I just caught a feel for it, but it had a wingspan probably that big. And I didn't hear a sound. It was just suddenly there. What it was a barn owl. Now, owls have this ability to fly with incredible silence, unlike any other birds. You move anything through the air, it makes sound. But somehow the owl is like the stealth fighter of the avian world. And it can fly at night with these huge eyes and just swoop down on rodents and other, you know, forest animals, and they don't hear a thing coming. They're just all of a sudden meat, you know, they're dead meat. Just grabs them with its claws. Now, God designed this. Well, what does that matter? Well, it turns out that the owl's wing led to quieter computer fans. See, the original computers, way back in the early 90s, they were really loud. They weren't very efficient. They put out lots of heat. So they put these great big fans that were kind of annoying. I remember turning on the Commodore 64 computer, and it's like, it's really loud. Well, now they're not. Well, what they did was study, how does this bird move through the air without making sound as air moves past it? Because we're just moving air. And they realized that there are notches at the end of these birds' wings. All these feathers that sticks out have these little notches. And they disturb the turbulence that is created as that wing moves through the air and causes it to somehow either circulate or turn back into like straight lamellar lines so it doesn't make a lot of noise moving past it. And the designers started putting little notches on the end of these fan blades. And they're 20 to 30% quieter as they move air. Because God did it first. See, this is just so cool. All these things that affect all these different things. Now, what all of this is called, I'm going to give you about half a dozen more examples, is biomimicry. Bio meaning it's of biological origin. Mimic is to copy. So we're copying things of biological origin. Now, sadly, and by the way, it's a rapidly growing area of both medical science and engineering, and it has been for decades. Most engineering schools have a course on biomimicry, as do medical schools. Evolution is always credited with those original designs. Oh, just those are useful features, so they evolved. And the world throws the word evolved at it, and because it's useful, it's assumed to be true. Now, at the end, I'm going to use this wagon, and I'm going to show you that could not possibly be the truth. It's a flat-out lie that's deceiving generation after generation, and I'm going to show you why. Okay, we're going to look at some other examples. What invention do you think a tree called the Osage orange resulted in that changed the course of American history? Okay, that's what the fruit of the Osage orange tree looks like. And without this tree, the development of this nation would have slowed down dramatically, the whole nation. Any ideas? What did you say? Still couldn't hear you. Anybody? Nothing? I sometimes have people say, oh, it's a golf ball, but I'm not sure that would have slowed the development of the nation, or medicine ball, or soccer ball. But that's not the right field of study. So I'm going to give you clues, some clues as I go along with all of these. The invention was inspired by this tree, and it was developed by Michael Kelly, and it was first patented and manufactured in 1868. So it goes way back, 1868. It sells 200 million pounds of it every year, even today. So here's an invention that's coming up on about 160 years old, and it still sells like crazy. And if you were to put this thing end to end and stretch it out, it would reach over 1 million miles every year. So it's a lot of it out there. Okay? Now, going to give you a little history. In the early 1800s, I think it was 1803 or 4, Thomas Jefferson made the land purchase of the millennium. He bought the Louisiana Territory from France because they were at a war with England, needed money, bought it for 3 cents per acre. So he doubled the area of America with one purchase at bargain basement prices. Now, he had all that land, so that's when Lewis and Clark were sent out to explore all this land that America now owned, all the way up the Mississippi River Valley, and they went all the way across it to the Rocky Mountains, and then they went on out across Washington and Oregon to the Pacific Coast. And it took almost a year to do it, came back, and it got the whole eastern United States excited. And the government started giving land grants for people to move, and if they moved out there, they could get all sorts of free land. And they did so. They did so in the tens of thousands, followed by the hundreds of thousands. It was a massive migration west of our country. And to supply all these people, they had port cities. Okay, St. Louis was a port city. Chicago was a port city. And urban major metropolitan areas started to develop. So now you have a society that's moving from an agricultural society to an urban culture with big cities, but you've got to feed all these people. Tens and then hundreds of thousands of people living in tight urban metropolitan areas. And the most efficient food source of the day were cattle, because you can feed a lot of people with a 2,000-pound cow versus a 2-pound chicken, okay? But to economically raise cattle, you've got to contain them. Now, in the East, you have all sorts of wood, and you'd build picket fences free. But out west, you've got the Great Plains states with no wood. So what farmers would do, they would plant Osage orange trees, okay? And they'd plant these trees, and they would grow in hedge lines, and they could fence in huge fields, but it would take 5 to 10 years to have a really effective fence. And the reason it's effective fence is because these trees have these big, nasty thorns everywhere on their branches and their stalks. And just like you wouldn't like to shove yourself through those thorns, neither do cows. Anybody now know what the invention was? Barbed wire. And by the way, if you look at barbed wire, look at the similarity. It's essentially identical. It's a long, you know, major branch with very pointed little spikes sticking out. As a matter of fact, Michael Kelly called his company the Osage Orange Barbed Wire Company. Now, he became very, very rich. And as I was reading about this, it referenced a kind of a college history paper that said it was barbed wire that allowed the taming of the West and the feeding of a growing nation. And it was more important than the Colt 44. It was barbed wire. Major technological development that allowed a nation to be fed. Now, we're going to go to the next one. What can we learn from a wasp's nest? Now, this goes back to a French invention. Clear back in 1719, René-Antoine Remoir was walking through the woods, and he got stung by a wasp, and he looks up, multiple wasps, and he sees this wasp nest. But instead of just getting mad, he starts thinking about it, okay? Now, to understand the importance, you got to realize that in the 1400s and 1500s and 1600s, right up into the 1700s, the only people who had books were very rich people. And there was no reason to teach people how to read because nobody could afford books. Because books were made out of linen, which is basically the fibers of cloth, old cloth, which is like dissolved and then recast into fine sheets. And then those sheets were printed. The printing press had been invented. And then they were sewn together with a leather binding, and they were very expensive. So Bibles and books of knowledge, they were only owned by the upper class. Well, I think you know where I'm going. René-Antoine, hang on just a second, he looked at this insect and what it was making. You know, inside of it is a little egg sac. But it's just surrounded by layer after layer after layer of this really, really thin, really, really smooth, really, really fine gray paper. Now, he didn't even call it paper. He didn't know what to call it. That word was coined later. But he realized this stuff is flatter and thinner than the linen we are using to make books out of. And if this stupid little stinging insect can chew up a piece of a tree and then recast it into this really fine paper, why can't we do it with all of our intelligence? And he spent decades not just trying to do it, but trying to figure out a manufacturing process for doing it. Now, the Chinese were making paper clear back 2,000 years earlier, and the Japanese, but they were doing it in a very manual process where very limited amounts were made. He figured out how to do it in a mass manufacturing process. And paper became very common and very cheap. And that totally changed the world we live in. See, without paper, we'd have no way to capture images, and the whole photography industry would have never developed. You had a paper after those 10 types realized they're expensive and they're slow. It was paper that drove the photography industry. You know, you couldn't do fun things like, you know, make paper airplanes without paper. That one didn't fly very well. You couldn't have books. You know, I wouldn't be able to sell books. It's like, think, there wouldn't be any reason to teach people how to read. Knowledge would have been stymied. There would have been a continual class of people that were better than others. You wouldn't be able to send stuff with envelopes and newsletters and, you know, get junk mail. All of it wouldn't happen. How about money? We'd still be carrying all these coins in our pocket because there'd be no printable money without paper. Can you imagine the world I'm describing? That's the world we would have without paper. You know, we wouldn't have the quicker picker-upper without paper, because it's so cheap we can soak up spills with it. We wouldn't have cardboard boxes. I forgot to bring my cardboard box up. You know, Amazon.com wouldn't exist because we'd still be shipping stuff around in barrels without paper. And most important, we would... We'd still be grabbing leaves out of the forest for toilet paper. You know, the whole scientific revolution, the Reformation, it all was predicated on people being able to read God's word for themselves and transfer information cheaply from generation to generation. All because this guy looked at a wasp nest. All because God did it first. That's what I mean. All of human civilization has been changed because we've studied creation. Now, here's another development. a little beetle. What could this little beetle, called a timber beetle, have done for us? Well, this was invented by Joseph Cox in 1946. He was sitting at lunch, eating his lunch after working really hard all morning, and he's on a stump, and he notices this little beetle is just chewing away at the wood. It's got these little mandibles, and they're just slicing back and forth and slicing through the wood fibers. And he looks closer and closer at it, and he becomes really curious. Now, why did this matter? Because Joseph Buford Cox was a lumberjack, okay? Now, this was 1946, and they had gas-powered chainsaws back then, all right? But the chainsaw blades, right up until 1946, were made just like saw blades. If you ever look at a saw blade, it's got a little pointed tooth that's angled a little bit to the left, and the next pointed tooth is angled a little bit to the right, left, right, left, right, and it chews away at the wood. And back then, they would have contests, and chainsaw blades were made with those same little pointed teeth, offset a little bit to the right and the left, and they would have guys with a chainsaw in a contest with guys with a crosscut saw, and two people on a crosscut saw could cut things down much faster than a person with an electric chainsaw or a gas-powered chainsaw. Well, he noticed that the little mandible-like teeth on this beetle, they weren't little points. They were carved like one of these Arabian swords, kind of at an angle. And the one on the right was angled one way, and the one on the left was angled the other way, and they would slide past each other. And he thought, what if we made a chainsaw blade that had a little curved surface instead of a little point? So he had himself a chainsaw made this way, and it was like 10 times faster slicing through wood than the little points. And he realized he made this design based on the design of a beetle that God had created. And if you look at the chainsaw, I should have probably had a little closer up view, but this little tooth is angled that way, and that little tooth is angled this way, and they just slide past one another, and they slice through the wood instead of just chipping away at it. It's way, way, way more efficient. And he called his company the Oregon Chainsaw Company. It's still the major chainsaw manufacturer in the world today. It all came from looking at a beetle that God had made first. What is the smallest human bones in our body? The ear. I hear people saying ear. You've learned that in school, and you're right. We call them the stirrup, the anvil, and the hammer, because they've got that sort of general shape. Now, there was an invention that changed everything, and it's still, the world is reaping the benefit of this today, and it's over 100 years old. And here's the quote from the man who made this invention as he studied the bones in the human ear. He said, "It occurred to me that if you had a membrane as thin as tissue paper, just as thin as one of these little pieces of toilet paper or thinner, okay, a membrane really thin, if something that thin could control the vibration of those three bones, so the bones are probably 100 or 1,000 times heavier than that teeny little membrane, massive compared to that little membrane. But if this little membrane, the eardrum, could control the vibrations of those bones that are immense in size and weight, why wouldn't a larger, thicker membrane be able to vibrate a piece of iron in front of an electromagnet?" Anybody know what the invention is? A speaker, but not just a speaker, more than that. And by the way, this is Alexander Graham Bell. What did he invent? What's he famous for? The telephone. For a telephone to work, there has to be a microphone that converts sound waves to an electronic signal that will go through a wire. Then that signal, that up and down undulation of a certain magnitude and period, will then hit an electromagnet at the other end. The sound will move the iron filings that will then move a membrane that recreates sound waves, which is the speaker. So you have sound being converted to electricity, moves through the wire, and the electricity moves iron filings that moves the membrane that recreates the sound. That's what a telephone is. And he got the idea from the eardrum moving bones, which move a fluid, which move little hairs, which create an electric signal and send the signal to the brain. Same concept, same principle. Now why? Alexander Graham Bell was not an electronics expert or an electrical engineer. He was a vocal physiologist. He was in essence a doctor. But this man had a deaf mother and a deaf wife, and he was wondering, how does the human ear work? How does it take sound and create it to a signal that the brain can interpret? And he realized it's that membrane moving that big bone. And he also knew that when you move iron in front of an electromagnet, it creates an electrical signal that could be sent through a wire. So he went on to invent speakers and microphones and the telephone. Now, trivia question. What was that first message transmitted over a wire? Anybody know? What was the actual message he sent? Anybody just shout it out if you remember it from school? Okay, someone said, what is God rod? Any other guesses? Okay, can't hear. Watson, come here. Okay, Watson, come here, I want you. Now, you're both sort of right. It was a trick question. The question was, what was the first message transmitted over a wire? That wasn't Alexander Graham Bell. That was Samuel Morse. Samuel Morse invented Morse code, and he would type using an electric impulses that would go over a wire for hundreds of miles, and at the other end there was a little pin that would create dots and dashes based on that signal, and he assigned meaning to the dots and dashes. That's what a language is, assigning meaning to a symbol, and then it could be written down and interpreted as a message. Samuel Morse was an incredibly active, strong, Bible-believing Christian, and when he invented Morse code and the telegraph, he wanted the first message to be very, very significant. So the first message mankind had ever sent over a wire, way beyond our ability to speak and talk, was the message, and you got that one right, what has God wrought? Now, that is an old King James word that means made. What has God made? As the message he wanted to transmit, to give credit for where the idea even came from to pass messages through a wire. He wanted to give credit to God. What God has made has allowed us to understand things and make similar useful inventions. And I think that's really significant that he would use that message. Now, Alexander Graham Bell, I'm not sure whether he was a Christian or not. His message was much less significant. He sent his assistant into another room, and his first message over the telephone was, Watson, come here. I need you. And he just wanted to know if the message he went through and was understandable. And sure enough, Watson comes running. And for the first time, human voice had been transmitted over a wire. It was very scratchy and very hard to understand. But look at what has developed. Without Alexander Graham Bell's invention, there would be no televisions, there would be no radios, there would be no transatlantic cables and communication between Europe and America, there would be no cell phones, there would be no TVs, there would be no internet, there would be no need for telecommunication satellites. All of the modern world is a response to a man looking at what God had designed in the human ear and using those principles to develop modern transmission of voice over a line, speakers and microphones. Real quick, I'm probably wrapping up here within the next 10 minutes. Useful inventions. Another Frenchman was walking through the woods in 1941. He came back and had all of these stupid sticking little seed pods all over himself and his dog. Anybody ever happened to you? I mean, I've been through cockaburrs and I've had hundreds of them up and down my legs if I step in the wrong spot. And it takes a long time to pick them all off. But instead of just getting irritated, he started wondering what makes them stick so well. And he spent 14 years trying to duplicate it. Anybody now know what this one is? Velcro. I mean, that is the way of putting on kids' shoes today. Did you know the astronauts and the space station, that is the primary method of attaching things as they're up in space, is Velcro. They've made Velcro out of a very resilient form of stainless steel that's so strong that they could lift up a railroad car with Velcro and just sticking the two things together. And as you look at these cockaburs, you look at these little hooks that then grab little fibers. He had to find a way of making them resilient and flexible and bouncing back and forth hundreds or thousands of times. That's what he developed, using modern plastics in the right kind, in the right shape, and the right manufacturing method. And it's exactly what God designed to spread seeds all over creation so plants can propagate over wide distances. What could we learn from a dog's paw? I tried to pick things that I didn't know. They kind of surprised me when I read about them. Well, if to understand this invention, you have to understand the man who looked at it to figure out something. His name was Paul Spiri, goes back to 1935, loved to sail, okay? So he'd go out sailing. And sailing shoes, and essentially all shoes at that day, were made of leather, okay? And it was pretty commonly accepted that the larger the surface area, the contact area, the more traction you would have. So all leather shoes were just flat on the bottom. That's how they were made. No ridges or anything. And he noticed when he was wearing his leather deck shoes and water would wash across the deck, he would often slip and fall, but his dog, his Cocker Spaniel, would run back and forth across the deck and not slip or fall at all. Okay, it had perfect traction. And he started to look at the dog's foot and he realized, my dog has little leather pads on the bottom of his feet. My shoes have leather pads on the bottom, the leather at the bottom of it. Why is it able to have traction and I don't? And he started to think, well, you know, the dog doesn't have a solid leather pad. It has grooves in between the pads. It's like there's a V-shaped groove. This is, in essence, another V-shaped groove. There's a V-shaped groove. There's a V-shaped groove. And he went on to develop what's called deck shoes. And they have this herringbone pattern. And you have very little surface area. The actual surface area is only about 20% of what it would be in a solid shoe. But now, anytime you have water, the water has channels to channel away. So you maintain traction instead of hydroplaning across a wet surface. And every tire, every bicycle tire, every automobile tire, whether it's little bumps or whether it's channels or whether it's grooves, all essentially end up with this V-shaped pattern that allows water to channel away. It's like it's the design of everything we need for traction today. Based on what? Because God did it first. This man copied the design and came up with improved traction. Now, I kind of like this one because I like scuba diving. I mean, God must have had a really bad day because why would he make a box-shaped fish? The stupid thing shaped like a box, for heaven's sakes. Now, this was studied by Nature magazine, or Science magazine. This is one of the quotes out of the article. It said, this fish should swim about as well as a barn should fly. So, why would God do that? Except when biologists started to really study it, instead of just saying, well, that's a weird-shaped fish, and watch it on coral reefs, they realized this fish was able to maintain its position very, very easily with his teeny little stupid-looking fins off the side of the box than these really well-streamlined fish that would get swept back and forth even more easily. So automobile designers started to study, and they came up with these stupid box-shaped cars. Have you ever seen those running around? It's like, what are they thinking? Well, it turns out, clear back in the 1980s, Daimler Chrysler had this concept car where they made a car as best they could, the exact same shape and dimensions as one of these box fish. And then they put it in wind tunnels to test it. And they discovered by exactly copying the shape and design of what God had done, they would get these reverse vortexes forming at the corners that would cancel the drag because of the way the air flowed past the shapes of the corners and the exact dimensions. And they would actually be more aerodynamically efficient than a rounded, more aerodynamically shaped car. It was based exactly on the box design. It had this vortexes forming at the corner, excellent maneuverability, great gas mileage, 70 miles a gallon, and it was better than an equivalent weight and shaped car that didn't have that shape. Isn't that cool? Because God did it first. Last couple, construction techniques. What can we learn from the giant lily pad? Now, there's a little girl sitting on water in this little paper-thin membrane. You would think she would just break right through and it would sink. Actually, with these, a 200-pound man can just walk from lily pad across the pond on these things. Well, they're designed with this incredible reinforced structure underneath supporting this really thin membrane, so it gives them incredible strength, and it supports a lot of weight. What did this lead to? Well, the botanist in 1851, they had what they called the Great Exhibition in London, England. Now, we're in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. We're developing all sorts of technology and skyscrapers and buildings and railroad steam engines and so on. And we want to showcase man's knowledge. So they had a contest, who can build the most fabulous building ever constructed by mankind? And they had all these architects and engineers sending in designs, but Joseph Paxton, a botanist, he proposed a building from the outside looking like it was made entirely from glass, a total glass structure. It was called the Crystal Palace. It was built for the Great Exhibition in 1851. It was made out of 200,000, like 6-foot by 6-foot panes of glass on the outside, 10 stories tall, okay? Now, this isn't a steel skyscraper on the outside. It's just total glass, 108 feet. It covered 18 acres. I mean, this was a fabulous building. This is what it looked like after the construction was complete. It was pretty stunning, okay? Now, the experts in construction techniques, they said it is guaranteed to collapse, okay? Because of all the weight. We're talking millions of pounds. So what did he do? He copied the exact structure of a lily pad to support all that weight. And it stood for decades. Now, eventually, some fire happened, and it weakened the steel structure, and it collapsed, and it's gone. But it was the design of God that allowed it to happen. One last thing is, what would the human hip help design? And it turns out there was an engineer, and now we had another world exhibition in another major European city, 1889, and he decided he's going to build the tallest building ever built by mankind. Okay, now at that time, all tall buildings were built straight up with all the support structure straight down from the center of mass of the building. But they would still tend to start to teeter in the wind, and they were limited to about 10 stories or so. But he decided he wanted to build a building way over 1,000 feet tall. And he proposed the design. And again, the experts said it's guaranteed to collapse. It was 1,064 feet tall. Any guesses what this building was? Empire State Building, good guess. All right, you guys are too good for me. Yep, it was the Eiffel Tower, okay? Now, it weighed millions of pounds of iron, but you'll notice, unlike a skyscraper, the support structure is thrown out to the side. That's exactly what the human hip is. Our center of mass is right down the center, but the two areas that support all this weight are off to the side of the center, and that's what he did with the Eiffel Tower. And again, it was predicted to collapse in an enormous disaster. It's still a major European tourist attraction to this day. Matter of fact, it was the tallest building built in, let me get the number right, I believe 3,800 years of human history. There was another building that held the record for the tallest human building. And for 3,800 years, no human culture, no society, no engineer, no architect had ever built a building as tall as this original building. It held the record for 3,800 years. So the tallest building ever built by humanity was built at the very beginning of all human civilizations. And by the way, that's the topic tomorrow morning, the brilliance of ancient mankind. And that was the Great Pyramid of Giza. It was some 500 and some feet tall, and this one almost doubled that record. But it held the record for 3,800 years at the beginning of human civilization. Okay. Now, medical applications are just off the chart. Cancer treatments, itching treatments, antibiotics, health treatments, cures for poisonous bites by animals, all sorts of stuff, hundreds of them, have been found by the chemicals that were found in plants and animals. And the medical industry constantly is looking for these. Last example, then I'm going to wrap up. We just came through COVID with, it's not caused by a bacteria, it's been caused by a virus, but bacteria are increasingly resistant to various antibacterial drugs. So researchers are constantly looking for better ways to kill bacteria. What turns out, as they started studying different animals, they discovered that the wings of a cicada and the wings of a dragonfly have very, very, like, orders of magnitude less bacteria on them than other surfaces. Our bodies actually have more bacteria on the surface and inside of them than we have cells in our body. I mean, we're more bacteria than we are human, in a way. And yet these wings have very, very few bacteria. And they thought, there's got to be a great antibacterial drug on these wings. But they couldn't find anything. They couldn't find anything that kills bacteria, any chemical, until they studied the structure of the wings. And what they discovered is that those wings are made with billions of little nano bumps, little spikes, like a bed of spikes. And when a bacteria comes and lands on the wing of a cicada or a dragonfly, the weight of the bacteria slowly pull it down to where these spikes puncture the bacteria. And then the bacteria deflates and it dies. So the very surface is an antibacterial surface structure. Isn't that cool? And scientists are now trying to manufacture these structures. Because if you could, you could have doorknobs and bed rails and walls inside of medical facilities where bacteria couldn't survive, and you wouldn't even need to use chemicals. Isn't that neat? Because God did it first. We discover these things. Now, I want to end here, and I'm going to give you that full quote from Job. Ask the beasts, and they will teach you. The birds of the heaven, they will tell you. The bushes of the earth will teach you. The fish of the sea will declare to you. And then notice the part I've underlined. Who among all of these, all of nature, does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? All of this exists because God made it. That's the point. And that's the point that's forgotten by the modern world around us. You see, God defines what is a fool. The very word fool is defined by God as anybody who would say or think in their heart, there is no God. And that's the basis of all the stuff that goes on with evolution. And it comes by various names, evolution or just mutations, random changes, causes designs to happen. And it's going to sound really convincing to students because Charles Darwin proposed a method that made it sound logical called natural selection. And the idea is that if an animal has an offspring, and that offspring has little variations, and it absolutely is true, it's going to happen, and those variations are useful, and there's lots of examples in the museums and the textbooks and videos and on the internet of variations of animals that are very useful. Bacteria will have variations, and some of those are going to allow them to survive better than their parents. So those bacteria are going to grow and propagate themselves better. And if this happens over and over again, over lots of time, little random changes to the genetic code that have a useful function, and that does happen, then maybe one animal will slowly take over and develop new characteristics. And now if you have millions of years or billion years, and it happens hundreds of thousands and millions of times, why couldn't one animal transform itself into a different kind of animal? And the students are given examples of changes that are useful. So it's going to be very, very convincing when they hear this. Well, it does seem to explain things. Things just adapt to become better. Well, let's look at that. And this example came from probably one of the world's most renowned geneticists who taught. His PhD was in genetics, plant genetics. He taught that at Cornell University for his whole career. But later in his career, he started to realize that everything isn't evolving more complexity and more information and more abilities. Everything is deteriorating that we actually study. It's losing information. So this whole idea of increasing information and complexity isn't even true when we study it. And this is the example he gives. And this is where I want to end, because I don't want to just give you a bunch of fun examples. I want you to think and be able to share why is evolution not true. Because it's going to sound logical to the world around us. It's going to sound logical to your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren as they're going through school. And if you can just take 2 minutes and explain why natural selection can't be true, to explain how a bacteria became a human being, all of a sudden they're able to resist the information they're getting and start to believe in the Bible more firmly. So let's just assume, as an analogy, that this wagon is a mode of transportation that's very, very simple. It's like a single-celled organism. Now, when I was growing up, I had a wagon like this, you know, and I liked to ride around in the wagon. But as I got older, my friends would, you know, they would have bicycles. And then as you get older, some of them in the teens would start to get mopeds and motorcycles. And as you're a later teenager in high school, you'd be driving around in a car. But just suppose, you know, I grew up in the 1960s. And I just didn't want a bicycle, and I didn't just want a motorcycle or a car. You see, what I loved to watch on TV were these science fiction shows, and what I really wanted to drive around in was the Starship Enterprise. Whoops, right here, the Starship Enterprise, right there. You know, and I didn't even just want a bigger wagon, okay? That's me in a big wagon. I wanted the Starship. Now, the difference between a little red wagon, which is analogous to a bacteria, and a human being is the difference between the wagon and you know, the Enterprise. It's got the warp drive engines and the photon torpedoes and the transporter beams. I mean, think of the information you have to add to the wagon to turn it into a spaceship. Lots of information would have to be added. Now, is natural selection going to do this? This is how natural selection works. The wagon rolls off the assembly line, and I've lost my pen. Okay, I need the pen for this illustration. Aha, here's one. Okay, rolls off the assembly line, and to make the next wagon, you have to take all the information needed to build the factory to create the wagon and recreate an entirely new factory to make the second wagon. And that information comes from a book that's attached to the first wagon. Okay? This is the DNA code. So you get all this information and you make a copy of it, and then you build the next factory and make the second wagon. That's what life does. Okay? Now, it's page after page of information. It's a code. It's a language. But every time a bacteria makes the next bacteria, there are guaranteed to be random changes called mutations. It's like, I'll take this page and I'm going to mark out one letter. Okay, and then let's say 100 pages later, I add a letter. And then 100 pages later, I move one word from here and I move it over to here. And 100 pages later, I mark out another letter. And suppose there's 1,000 pages in the book. In every 100 pages, I make one little typo. Those are mutations, and they're random. They're not guided. They're just random changes to a book of information. Now, that's what happens in life when a bacteria makes the next bacteria. Has anybody ever read a long book, and there's been 10 misspelled words, or some number of misspelled words? You ever read a book, and you've seen a misspelled word? If there's only one misspelled word every 100 pages, do you think you'll be able to read and comprehend what that book has to say? One misspelled word every 100 pages. Absolutely. It's still going to function. Now you take that book and you make the next wagon. Now that book has a mistake not every 100 pages, every 50 pages. The third wagon has a mistake every 25 pages. After 10 books, there's a mistake, one mistake. I mean, so after 10 generations, you have a mistake every 10 pages. After 100 generations, there's a mistake on every single page. After 1,000 generations, there's 10 mistakes, 10 misspelled words, 10 rearranged words on every page. After, 10,000, there's 100 misspelled, misplaced words on every page. You see what's happening? The information is disappearing. Now, natural selection, what does it do? It takes the wagon, and it looks at the wagon, and it says, is this wagon past the quality? Will it sell well in the market? It can't see the book. Natural selection can't see the DNA code. It can't correct anything in the DNA code. It can only see, does the wagon function well? And early on, it will. But if there's a major change, now the factory doesn't work right, maybe a wagon comes out and the wheels are wobbly. So it will be eliminated. That mistake that was major will be eliminated, but all the other wagons are going to get passed, and they're going to go out, and they're going to get a little worse, and a little worse, and a little worse, and the information's going to get worse, and it's going to be destroyed. Now, here's what the students get to hear. They don't get to hear that perspective. They get to hear that, well, you know what? Here's an example of a random change where the word blue, red, got changed to blue, and that blue wagon, it actually works better. It sells well. That's the analogy. It survives well out in the environment. See, this is an example that proves evolution makes something that's going to compete better in the natural world. And there are examples of things like that, random changes that have a functional purpose. But that blue wagon, it just took with it all of those little tiny changes that are destroying information and slowly getting worse and worse and worse. And no new complexity was added. The changes that are proposed never increase the level of information. Start warp drive engines start to appear, start new body structures start to appear, create new organs. None of that has ever occurred or ever been seen or ever even been shown how it could happen by evolution. Meanwhile, things are getting worse and worse and worse. Now, the last thing, a classic example of evolution proof in the textbooks. When salamanders or fish end up trapped inside of dark caves, they will actually have lots of variations. And over time, very routinely, one of them will lose sight because the brain uses about 20% of its capacity to interpret visual images in both animals and human beings. So if an animal living in perpetual darkness no longer has to deal with visual images, that frees up the brain to be used for other ways. And that animal literally has an advantage when it lives in a cave. So it's told to students, see, this mutation to blindness is an evolutionary example of how evolution works to improve an animal and give it new abilities. But I want you to think about this. This is what students aren't told. Suppose you had a big movie theater full of people, 500 people in a movie theater, and one of those persons brought his blind brother. So all his life this man's been blind. And then during the movie, the lights all go out and it's totally black and someone yells, fire! And panic ensues. And people are being trampled. Of those 500 people, which one is going to function better and be more likely to survive? The blind man. So therefore, that blind man is more evolved and he's evolving abilities to turn into a superhuman being. Does that make sense? No, he's lost ability that in a very small environmental niche gives him an advantage. But he's never gained information or gained anything that is new and improved. See, that's how students are deceived. They're given examples without a perspective to understand how it really fits into reality. Natural selection can never add information and make things more complex and cause things to evolve upward. And it's all smoke and mirrors and lies that the world around us is buying into because they're leaving out giving credit to God for all the designs that exist in life. So I wanted to end with that little bit of teaching to help you understand how solid the truth is and how we've got to use this sort of perspective and information to keep our kids and the people around us and our children from being deceived by what's just pure misinformation and misinterpretation of the world purely because we're leaving God out of our thinking. And the saddest thing that ever happened to our country is when the Supreme Court in 1948 said we've got to have a separation of church from state, because creation involves God. It involves a belief in God, and it always will, and it has to. And by law, we've allowed a system to develop where anything dealing with God is by law told we've got to leave it out of the school and education system. So we have chosen to leave the truth out. And that only leaves naturalism. It only leaves evolution and adaptation. So it's taught as a fact. And it's been done so for now coming up on three generations. And we are now seeing the fruits of that, to the point where there's a time coming very soon where we as Christian leaders and Christian church teachers will be thrown in jail for simply teaching the truth. That's the next thing that's coming along. And we got to get busy getting the truth known to the world around us. So thank you again. That's why I'm here, to try to help people see what's at the root of all the other social issues that are happening. So it's the rejection of God's word. And that's based on the rejection of the early parts of the Bible. So thank you again.
Okay. Well, I certainly hope you've gained some appreciation.